And that was the Jolly Roger Comedy Troupe from Berkeley and Free Radio Berkeley. And what sounds like a three-year-old skit. Took a while getting to us, but hey, we got it to you. Who Dot Bombs, of course, was prosecuted extensively in San Francisco. Over 1,000 people were arrested. At least half those cases reached the courts. People had to continue to go in and out for court dates. But only one person actually was ultimately jury tried and convicted, and you're listening to him right now. I was sentenced to 2 months in jail, served, what was it, 27, 28 days, and was released. And after I was released, I guess partially because of the fact that some of us were willing to carry things through to their conclusion, the city under Brown stopped arresting Food Not Bombs servers when they were serving food, though certain Food Not Bombs members like Keith McHenry and Food Not Bombs in other cities continues to be harassed and prosecuted. And lest there be no mistake, Mayor Willie Brown of San Francisco has actually doubled Matrix-style arrests for sleeping, sitting, property, and has gone after people in the park, Golden Gate Park, viciously and with greater brouhaha than his predecessor, former police chief and Mayor Frank Jordan. The satire calls him Stank Florden. So the situation continues in San Francisco, and indeed, I heard recently from Paul Bowden of the Coalition on Homelessness, the group that puts out Street Sheet, one of the two homeless papers sold in San Francisco, that the city is planning a campaign to round up alcoholics, sweep alcoholics off the streets, that the Coalition and other groups, other civil liberties groups, are trying to head off. The plan would involve a third contact with a social service by a so-called alcoholic, would involve an automatic arrest, which of course sounds unconstitutional, and who knows, perhaps I don't have all the details clear here, I just am recalling from one conversation with Paul. There also are plans to institute what's called the Manhattan Matrix in San Francisco. Manhattan has cleared its homeless community from Manhattan. I'm told by those who live there it's really hard to find homeless people on the streets. They've been moved into the boroughs to put them out of sight and to coordinate with the gentrification program going on in Manhattan. One of the elements of that plan is a requirement that shelters send lists of all the people who are in the shelters back to the police department, who then come out surreptitiously, silently, and pick up anybody with warrants. Which is, of course, it was, similar plan was proposed in Arizona, and Prescott, Arizona, actually. And we're going to be hearing a little interview from Prescott later in the show. That plan was largely rejected. It actually involved issuing ID cards for homeless people for social services, so you would have to go through warrant checks in order to get hot soup, things of that sort. The plan in San Francisco is to make all the social services on the same computer, so there's immediate access to all information about people, and information that is indeed required before you can get minimal social services. We're not talking about money, we're talking about lodging, food, blankets. It would be a draconian scheme to further wrap people up in the legal system if they have, let's say, a warrant for sleeping on a bench, or in Santa Cruz, covering up with a blanket after 11 o'clock at night. It would, of course, discourage people from using social services, so the social services could claim, as state welfare services now want to claim in order to get federal money, that they are cutting their welfare rolls. It might be easier simply to simply cut in half every third homeless person, which would be another quick way of cutting those rolls. Anyway, it's grim, and we have some interesting reports from San Jose, hopefully coming up later. We talked to Charlie of San Jose Food Not Bombs, and we'll hopefully have an interview with him, but I don't want to promise it to you, because a lot of it depends on time, whether I can find the proper tape, and how much dope I'm smoking. No, just kidding, I'm not really much of a dope smoker here. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, as you probably know, 96.3 FM. What I'm going to play now, in order to keep us all current, is the latest from SCAN. SCAN is the Santa Cruz Action Network, the group that gave us the wonderful lineup of city council members that we now have. Rotkin, Matthews, I guess Hernandez was not really scan endorsed, but he kind of, I think he was lurking around and getting, he was the Hispanic, who was going to be so concerned about racism, and indeed is so concerned that he is taken no position whatsoever, actually has taken a hostile position on changing the sleeping ban law, which we presume is somehow Hispanics are magically exempted from and aren't being arrested or ticketed for. Anyway, SCAN is an important organization which has a lot of influence in election endorsements. It does a good organizing job in getting people out to vote, and so its endorsements and its opinions are worth taking a look at, even though in the past they've largely been controlled by insiders. This year there seems to be kind of a rebellion on the loose, and SCAN is, well, as we know, a year ago it endorsed, supposedly as an action item, the sleeping ban, making the sleeping ban repeal key priority. And of course they really didn't do much around that, and they failed to mention the issue in their newsletters at crucial points, and of course at the SCAN forum last Wednesday, which they shared with labor and students in deciding which city council candidates to endorse, they failed to ask any questions about the sleeping ban in their written literature, though that was made up for by questions from the audience. Indeed, one of the questions from the audience, I'm told, the one that got the largest number of votes isn't the right word, but it was turned in, it was the question most frequently asked by an audience person, and I got to tell you, I only asked it once. I didn't pack the ballot box. I was there. What about the sleeping ban? What would you do about that? And we got a lot of answers on the panel. Unfortunately, the first two people who answered the question were Jane Walton and Keith Sugar. Jane's answer was completely missed by me because my tape recorder ran out of gas at that point. And Keith Sugar's answer was largely missed because I tuned in only at the end of his statement. However, we got the rest of the statements. We're going to play them for you now. What do our current city council candidates running for election in November think about the ordinance that makes it illegal for people to sleep or cover up with blankets after 11 o'clock at night, even though there are essentially no legal places for the overwhelming majority of them in Santa Cruz city limits? The Jane Walton misstated the ordinance, taking her cue from the Santa Cruz Sentinel, calling it the camping ordinance. We're not talking about the camping ordinance, we're talking about the section of the camping ordinance called the sleeping ban. And of course, that's always ignored by opponents because it doesn't sound very humane, very liberal, very sensible, very cost-effective to talk about criminalizing sleep. It sounds pretty ridiculous, actually. But therefore they call it camping, which sounds a lot more regulatable and reasonable to control. But we're not talking about camping, we're talking about sleeping, and that we're talking about specifically the sleeping section of the camping ordinance, not the tent section, not the building a fire section, not the setting up a permanent place to dwell section, not the blocking the sidewalk situation. We're not talking about sleeping in doorways at block merchants, all these bugaboos which are thrown out by people like Mayor Mike Rotkin when he defends the sleeping ban, because that's what he's defending. He doesn't call it that. He calls it the camping ordinance. Anyway, we're going to hear now from the SCAN forum. Jane Walton was a definite supporter of the sleeping ban and an opponent of changing it. And unfortunately, we do not have her, what I consider, preposterous comments on tape. I've invited her to come into the studio for an interview, and hopefully she will. Maybe we'll interview her by phone. Keith Sugar then unequivocally came out against the sleeping ban, which I found really reassuring. Unfortunately, the other two liberal candidates that spoke, I should say two of the three other liberal candidates, Tim Fitzmaurice of the city's Transportation Commission and Chris Crone, a Beach Area Working Group activist, did not specifically state that they opposed the ban. They gave some pro-homeless comments, and Fitzmaurice talked about how ridiculous the ban was, but we saw no commitment to changing that law, which I think, of course, is a really basic point to begin with to support any of these council candidates. So I'm hoping that they are simply under educated on the issue, having focused a lot of their attention on the beach flats, and that they will come around. Let's hear what they have to say and what the other candidates, and the candidates you're going to be hearing from are, you're going to be hearing the end of Keith Sugar's comment. Keith is a local attorney who supports no development in the beach flats, at least not the current plan. The next speaker is Linda Steinau, who's the Downtown Association's woman and the woman to watch. She's probably going to be the most well-funded candidate. Rod Acuartarero, who is a perennial right-winger, followed by Chris Krohn, Tim Fitzmaurice, and finally Pat Clark, who is a reverend, janitor, man of color, person who actively supported our sleeping ban initiative repeal, and he speaks about it as well. I think he was another person who came out for repealing the sleeping ban. So only two of the four liberals and two of the total running race of eight came out against the sleeping ban. Rodent was not on the panel. Let's hear now from that panel.
I don't think there's any merit to that argument. This highlights the fact that the homeless are our responsibility and we've got to do something about it. We've got to fund the Homeless Resource Center. We've got to fund the Paige Smith House. We have to give these people the opportunities they want to be contributors to the society again.
I don't support the repeal of the Canton Ordinance. I do sit on the Board of Directors of the Homeless Community Resource Center. I'm very concerned about issues around homelessness, and our effort is in bringing people out of homelessness. Everything that we do is aimed at bringing people out of homelessness. And when we have the open air campground behind our site, it was not a good condition. The sanitary conditions, everything about that open air campground was not favorable to nice human living. And the Homeless Community Resource Center was severely taxed by the influx of people that came because of that open air camping. We are going into a deficit situation in our finances as we speak. We work constantly trying to maintain the funding, and the City of Santa Cruz is extremely supportive financially of the homeless services. We need a tremendous amount of community support, and yes, I agree that everybody deserves a place to sleep, and I for one am working towards that, but I don't believe that allowing people to sleep everywhere is the answer.
In large part, I agree with Keith and the things that he said, although I've got to disagree that this is what he said, that doing away with the sleeping ban won't create problems. He stated that he thinks that's arguable or not arguable. I think it's arguable. I mean, I'm having a problem with that one. I don't support doing away with the sleeping ban or camping ban. Logically, again, the greater majority of the homeless in our community need help and need rehabilitation. It wouldn't necessarily be the ones causing problems, the problems that other candidates talked about if allowed to camp throughout the city and areas. But again, there are those who will cause problems. There are those who will create problems for the environment, create safety problems, and so forth. And for no other reason other than that, I've got to stand with past council actions and say I wholeheartedly support the sleeping and camping ban as it is.
From my understanding, that the current sleeping ban makes it illegal to sleep in certain circumstances. I met recently with Karen Gillette, the Homeless Community Resource Center. We had a long conversation and we went over the numbers of how many people need shelter during the winter months and how many the city can provide, or actually how many the city can provide shelter for during the winter as opposed to the summer. During the summer, they provide well, excuse me, during the winter, there's like 200 spaces, bed spaces, and that's contracted through the Homeless Community Resource Center as well as various churches in the area and synagogues. During the summertime, that dropped to 28. So there's a problem here, that there's a difference, at least my math is right, there's 133 people that aren't being, at least, they're sitting somewhere in Santa Cruz. And this is an issue that the next council is going to have to deal with. And I'm ready to take that on, because I don't think there's an easy answer, but we do need more bed space. I don't either favor a return to the campground that, in the way it existed previously. I think there's a lot of questions to be answered, and I also think that we need to, right now, stabilize funding for homeless services and get the county to pay their share. So I would leave, when elected, I would negotiate with the county and figure the situation out. Because recently, the article came out in San Jose Mercury said that most homeless people are from Santa Cruz County. Thank you.
Tim Fitzmaurice is next.
I had a lot of trouble arresting people for falling asleep. I just can't get over that. And I think the community needs to come to grips with this issue. It's, I'm fine. I think the community needs to come to grips with this issue in an effective way. It tears us apart, tears apart all of us, to try to figure out how to solve the problem of people who have no place to live or a place to sleep for whatever reason. A homeless community is perhaps a quarter women, and it's composed of children, and it's composed of people who are momentarily out of work, and it's composed of people that need support and need help. I'm not sure that by tearing the community apart over the sleeping ban or something like this, you're necessarily going to get to the heart of the issue that we're really trying to deal with. I guess I would work effectively not arrest people for sleeping. At the same time, I think our real effort has to go into improving homeless resources in a broader sense, finding new funding, incidentally, funding that should probably come from other agencies, not just the city, because we have the largest impact of homeless population in the city, perhaps, but those people come from all over the county and other areas nearby. About 70% there formerly lived in Santa Cruz, and to think of it as community members that are currently out of house, not necessarily a strangers who somehow wanted into our neighborhood. We need to do something effectively to find the funding to make the homeless resources work for this community.
Is there a way to affordable housing? That's the one thing we need. No.
Other people perhaps become. This is a personal question for me, because having been homeless, I know what it's like not to have a place to rest your head, not to have a place to use your restroom, not to have a place to wash. One of the biggest things for me was, what did I look like when I went out into the public? Because I didn't have a mirror except in the rear, my rear mirror of my car. So I feel the city should repeal the sleeping ban. I don't think it's right. I don't think it's just clump persons that may not make the in-between the place altogether. Everyone is homeless, everyone that's homeless is using a drug or alcohol. We're individuals, and that's the thing that we need to look at. Each individual prioritizing, like, the resources that we do have. But don't put me in, like, a percentage person to it. I'm an individual, and I'm trying to make it work in Santa Cruz. It's very difficult. So let's help the other persons that are trying to make it work. And so yes, let's not punish persons for sleeping. Let's be for sleeping down.
And that last speaker was Pat Clark, who, along with Keith Sugar, were the only two candidates at the forum to unequivocally come out for repealing the sleeping ban. You actually heard some half-sensible statements from Ron Quartararo, even from Linda Steinau. Again, though, they favored maintaining the sleeping ban for bad reasons. Quartararo favored maintaining it because of problem cases, instead of recognizing that problem cases can actually be dealt with through many laws. You don't need a law making... How can someone be a problem when they are asleep? I mean, if they're blocking the sidewalk, there's a law for that. If they're urinating or defecating, there's a problem. There's a law for that. If they're littering, there's a law for that. And there are ways to deal with it short of a draconian go-to-sleep, go-to-jail ordinance, as we've known for years and said for years. This issue is much mystified. It is much covered up, and there's really a lot of bullshit slung around this issue. Likewise, the talk by Chris Krohn and Linda Steinau about the campground being a bad thing, though that's not the issue, the sleeping ban, the campground is not a bad thing, and we've talked about this at great length on this station. The campground had its problems, but many more people, many more homeless people died after the campground closed, when people were dispersed, no longer had a community, were no longer near, needed resources, no longer had a kind of a quick response system, no longer had the support from each other that they did get, although there were also problems because there was a group of alcoholics, and of course there were drug users, and there were people who were disabled, and they were all thrown together in crowded circumstances, where Karen Gillette refused to open her bathrooms at night, where the Citizens Committee for the Homeless refused to empty its porta-potties or do trash pickups at appropriate times. We're talking about the Coral Street open-air shelter that ran from 1994 through 1995 in the winter. There were many problems. Indeed, videos have been done around this issue, one of them called Campground, talking about the campground, another actually documenting how the campground itself was closed by City Council members Kennedy and Rotkin, with buyers sitting by, and Daryl Darling and Paul Marceau, who were the two people responsible for running the campground, essentially in the despicable behavior where people were begging them to keep the word that they had given to the campground, that they would keep it open or negotiate, and they refused to do either. They simply called in their pals on the city council, their allies, and had the place closed down after the first big rain of the season. Indeed, the campground was flooded for a day or two, but it was pumped out, it was ready to continue, and these people treacherously violated their word, claiming they needed to start Community House, the so-called Page Smith Community House, which didn't begin construction for a year and a half later. So it really was a disgraceful situation. As I said, people died afterward. I think from a half a dozen to a dozen people, if Dan Hopkins' figures are correct. Hopkins was the activist who, with Sean Alimi, started the City Hall Sleepers protest vigil in front of City Hall 3 months after the campground closed in March. And he has those figures. The campground issue, we need a low-income campground. It has been successful where it's been tried in places like Eugene, where it was successfully tried for 3 years, and it's much lied about by politicians like Rotkin, and really one has to use the word lie because Rotkin knows better and just is not willing to back down on this issue or to speak truth about this issue. The sad thing is to hear political candidates like Chris Krohn and even Linda Steinau, I guess I can expect it from Steinau, but mouthing these lies about the campground, this kind of ignorant fears about the campground, which to some extent are spread by people like Karen Gillette, who, you know, she had her own sort of services next to the campground, didn't appreciate it being placed there because it made a number of problems for her, but insofar as she's being funded by the city and county to provide homeless services for the homeless, I would think that she would be pleased to have a place where people could sleep at night and not be arrested. She certainly didn't open her facilities at night, even so far as opening the bathrooms. She still hasn't done that. Instead, we now have, instead of the campground, we now have this community house program, which provides 30 transitional beds for people who are willing to go into such a program, who have the money to go into such a program, since it's not free, and who are selected to go into such a program. And that's, you know, one doesn't want to condemn out of hand that program per se, but I have been a critic of it and where it's located, and that it's displaced the campground. The fact that it's It provides very restrictive circumstances for people and sort of plays in with this national model of only taking the very creme de la creme and then parading it around as though you're doing something for the majority of homeless people when you're only helping 30 out of 500 to 1,500 people. And you're supposed to be, you know, lauded and applauded for doing that. And the politicians always get away with this by saying, oh, we're going to do much more. We're going to do much more. It's not enough. Yeah. But at the same time, politicians like Steinau and Carterero and Walton, and unfortunately so far, Crone and Fitzmaurice are standing for things like keeping the existing sleeping ban. You can't have a law that makes it illegal for people to sleep if there's no legal place for them to sleep. It's a very simple statement. It's a very simple conclusion. I don't see how any rational person can dispute it. The only way and the only basis for disputing it is if you are afraid of some sort of political flack from business leaders and politicians in power who have a stake in maintaining an absurd and cruel ordinance that currently exists. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is also your station, and if you have access to a phone, we want to hear from you. If you got stuff to say around the issues we're hearing on the air now. Phone number is 427-3772, 427-3772. Labor Day is sort of a traditional day of demonstration for many different groups, and in Santa Monica, there's going to be a big protest. Santa Monica, for those of you who don't know, is a sort of a suburb of Los Angeles on the coast. It is also the site of a homeless paper called Making Change, and for many years, the homeless community there was quite active and struggling for its rights. There's going to be a demonstration the 5th, the 6th, and the 7th at the Santa Monica Pier to introduce the National Homeless Plan and to denounce anti-homeless policies of the City of Santa Monica, its City Council, and the Santa Monica Police Department. There'll be a press conference 10 a.m. next Saturday, September 5th, at the Cannon in Palisades Park at the corners of Ocean and Colorado Avenue. And Ted Hayes from Justiceville and the Dome Village in downtown L.A. will announce an alliance between Justiceville and Side by Side. Following the press conference, there'll be a Native American blessing. Food will be provided. There'll be a candlelight vigil daily at 9 p.m. This is going to go all weekend with information, petitions, and displays. So anybody who wants to go down to Santa Monica, do that and then report back. Tell us how it went. And if you want to go further, you can go down to San Diego, which is beyond Santa Monica by about 100, 150 miles, where there is an ongoing homeless community there and homeless protest called the People's Establishment. We've talked about the San Diego protest on the air before. There, 200 to 300 homeless people have been sleeping nightly in front of the city hall until they were dispersed by police, essentially without any legal basis, but they were essentially on threat of arrest. They left, and they've gathered at Horton Plaza, which is sort of another glitzy tourist area, previously a park, one of those parks like our own Triangle Park, which is now forbidden to people to walk through, like the town clock, which had been an open area of 24 hours a day, but thanks to council members, conservative council members like Cynthia Matthews, is now a closed area after 1 o'clock at night. It's illegal to protest there, or to have a demonstration, or even to fall asleep there. Of course, it's illegal to sleep everywhere in Santa Cruz, but it's illegal to have a vigil there and stay awake. And it was to eliminate sleeping ban protesters that town clock was closed down by the city council in 1991. Anyway, this demonstration in Santa Monica, here's a little of the background, keep you advised of what's going on in other cities. A three-day nonviolent rally and demonstration is going to be held over Labor Day weekend, reads this press release, starting on Saturday, September 5th, 1998 at 11 a.m. to speak out against the City of Santa Monica's and the Santa Monica Police Department's policies, attitudes, and behaviors against the homeless. There will be two separate locations, on the Santa Monica Pier by the Carousel and at the top of the pier by the Cannon at the corner of Ocean and Colorado Avenues. We are sick and tired of being harassed by a group of five renegade Santa Monica police officers. The officers in question are Officers Joseph Gardner, Sky Stone Eagle, a.k.a. Dennis Troy Lambert, Anthony Paez, Stephen Wong, Douglas Stroop, and Lieutenant George Centeno, who have been constantly harassing the Santa Monica homeless population. The forms of harassment include selective enforcement of ordinances, buses going down to the beach between the hours of 2 a.m. and 6:30 a.m. to wake up poor defenseless sleeping people by means of kicking, verbal abuse, or baton bashing to tell them to move while all the shelters are full, violations of proper search and seizure laws, violation of civil rights by use of physical force, to name a few. These fascist acts will no longer be tolerated. Homelessness is not a crime. However, homeless people in Santa Monica are treated like criminals. This press release has been given to the city manager's office, Detective Ralph Verbeck, Marsha Jones Mutry, city attorney, police chief James Butts, and each member of the Santa Monica City Council. On June 23rd, this sanctioned side-by-side event received the support of Ted Hayes, director of Justiceville Dome Village, who will also be present at the news conference on September 5th at 10 a.m., which will be located at the top of the Santa Monica Pier near the cannon on the corner of Ocean and Colorado. Native American Blessing will immediately follow the news conference to launch our peaceful, nonviolent, alcohol, and drug-free demonstration. We will have a nightly candlelight vigil starting at 9 p.m. It is time, ladies and gentlemen of the press, to make an example of the city of Santa Monica and put a stop to the Crow apartheid, neo-apartheid tactics. That's Jim Crow apartheid, neo-apartheid tactics of this and other Southland cities. Homelessness is not prejudice, and it doesn't care what you have now or are going to get later. Homelessness has no color, race, sex, or religious boundaries. The party is over, Santa Monica. It is time for justice, and we want it now. It is time for solutions, and we proposed the City of Santa Monica, the State of California, and the United States of America adopt the National Homeless Plan to eliminate this growing disgrace in one of the largest, wealthiest nations on earth. Wake up, America. Fascism is alive and well in Santa Monica. We must take a stand and return democracy, human rights, and dignity to each citizen, regardless of the size of their wallet. Isn't this the land of the free and the home of the brave? And again, we're talking about a protest in Santa Monica all weekend, Labor Day weekend demonstration and rally, September 5th, 6th, and 7th in Santa Monica, California. And for more information, give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I will give you more details about this demonstration. Well, that's good news. And of course, Santa Cruz is having its own Don't Sleep Tonight night, and that'll be tomorrow night. And the key here will be not to sleep in solidarity with homeless people who can't sleep, and then to call the city council and tell them if you were able to succeed. The phone number for calling the council, and it's a line that's open 24 hours a day, is 429-3550. I think shortly I'm going to be playing an interview with David Silva, a homeless activist who is housed himself, who is talking about that demonstration and other issues around the sleeping ban and civil rights for poor people, and he'll give you more details on that. Often is the time when I want to read and I don't have time to read, so I'm going to do a little reading here in the middle of Bathrobe's Pier's broadsides. And some of this stuff may seem a little off target to you, but I'm kind of a civil rights fan, and I may range a little bit. Before I do, though, it looks like we have an incoming call. Well, that was an incoming call. It looks like the person wanted to talk off-air. So I guess my advice to you is, if you want to talk to me off-air, is wait until a tape is playing, and then you can catch me. Otherwise, you are going to be broadcast, because we are looking for callers and other voices than mine. Anyway, here's something interesting I found on the San Francisco Examiner the day before yesterday. Peruvian sues U.S. for putting him in internment camp. And here's this interesting situation. As a Peruvian man, he's filed what is believed to be the first individual lawsuit against the U.S. government for sending him to a World War II internment camp. That was the famous camps that Japanese people were sent to, or people of Japanese ancestry, even though there was zero evidence that they were engaging in any kind of subversive behavior, but simply as a racial thing. But he's filed the first individual lawsuit. They refused to award him a $20,000 redress payment that was given to interned Japanese Americans. Koshi Oshima and more than 2,000 other Latin Americans of Japanese ancestry were kidnapped from South America and sent to U.S.-run internment camps in Texas at the same time as more than 120,000 Japanese Americans were put in camps across the West. Now, under a 1988 act, Japanese American internees received $20,000 each from the federal government, and more than about 81,000 Japanese Americans have been paid About 98% of those believed eligible, presumably the rest died. The deadline was to apply August 10th. And a settlement reached earlier this year made an estimated 700 to 1,000 Japanese Latin Americans eligible for $5,000 redress. That's one-fourth of the payment given to the Japanese Americans. But Shima is declining that payment and instead sued the government Tuesday for the $20,000 redress, arguing that he deserves as much as Japanese Americans. In a separate but related action, Shima also filed a $10 million claim against the U.S. government for his imprisonment, loss of Peruvian citizenship, and violation of equal protection rights. Christine DeBartolo, a spokeswoman for the Department of Justice, declined comment on the lawsuit. Messages seeking comment from the State Department regarding the claim were not returned Tuesday. Shima says that the $5,000 offered is a slap in the face for all he endured, being kidnapped from his home, then interned, and losing his Peruvian citizenship, among other things. "I'm going to be 75 pretty soon," he said. "I don't want to fight, you know, but I still have to finish this." The suit seeks not only $20,000, but an apology and funding for an education campaign on the internment experience of Japanese Latin Americans. Shima recalled when he had been 19, when government agents greeted him as he entered his uncle's coffee shop in Lima, Peru, in 1942. Shima, then a Peruvian citizen, two uncles, and a coffee shop employee were arrested. Jailed in Lima for about 6 weeks, their money and identification were seized. From there, they were crammed on a U.S. military boat to Panama with about 170 others. They spent about a week in Panama and were put into forced labor before being shipped to Long Beach. They were then sent to an internment camp in Kennedy, Texas. This is in the San Francisco Examiner on page A10, for those of you who want to look at the article on in the August 28th issue. And what really strikes me here is that still, 40 years later, this guy is getting the runaround. And here's a man who's still willing to stand up and speak out for basic rights and dignity. Here's an incoming call. Hey there, it looks like, sorry about that dead air, folks, it looks like we're on the radio with a caller, but I don't think he can be heard, our telephone line can be heard. Caller, say something. No, it's not showing. My apologies to those, and my thanks to to you, Rachel, for coming in and giving me the word on this. Apparently, the I'm going to have to kind of tell our caller goodbye for now, and I'll work on trying to fix the phones. Thank you. Boy. Well, that's a relief that we know, and I'm glad that we heard in time. Thank you. Boy. What I was saying on the phone that all of you heard silence about was the question the caller had to do with, is there a magnet effect? He was asking in local beach towns, is there an effect where, you know, that there is a legitimate concern of businesses and other residents that if they allow any kind of sleeping at all under any circumstances in their city outside of a pay campground, that there will be an influx of, as Rotkin put it in 1996, millions of homeless people. And the answer of Representative U.S. Representative Sam Farr, who said he's been on some homelessness committee and they've investigated this issue, is that that's complete bunk. That's not the reason homeless people move from city to city, and that, for instance, Eugene, which has allowed industrial camp zone camping for the last 10 months, they recently modified the law again, but there's been no such influx, no magnet effect. And similarly in California, there's been no magnet effect. I know that that was the claim of social service providers in Santa Barbara when they abolished completely their sleeping ban for 3 years, 1986 through 89, that there was no influx. That's just not really what happens. People do not consider it such a major benefit that they be allowed to sleep without being arrested. I mean, it's, you know, it takes a certain pressure off people who are trying to work. But again, it's not a heavenly situation, I don't think. And I really wish we had an operational phone line here so I could actually get some of your calls. I think I'm going to try and fix that during the next tape. But I appreciate the callers calling in. I'm going to continue with my clipping analysis. Another interesting story from an earlier Examiner. Hookers can suffer stress of battle, study shows. A lot of sex workers up and down the coast. I know some of them personally. I'm concerned about civil rights of people on the streets and people who do their business on the streets, and streetwalkers or people like that are concerned with, I'm concerned with their civil rights. And here's something about their situation. Being a streetwalker can be as traumatic as going to war, with more than half the prostitutes questioned for a study suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Prostitution is an act which is intrinsically traumatizing, concluded the study, led by Melissa Farley, a Kaiser Permanente psychologist. The study released Tuesday at the meeting in San Francisco of the American Psychological Association, that's several Tuesdays ago, found that 67% of prostitutes met the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder, a psychological reaction to highly stressful events. Researchers interviewed 475 hookers in five countries, the U.S., South Africa, Thailand, Turkey, and Zambia, and 62% reported being raped, 73% said they'd been physically assaulted, and 68% said they'd been threatened with a weapon. Prostitutes suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder at levels of severity comparable to Vietnam veterans, the study found. Not every woman in the business feels that way. My job is stressful and my job has bad days, but it's way better than anybody else's I know, said Veronica Manet, a 38-year-old prostitute who works out of a downtown apartment building. The most stressful thing about my job is that it's illegal. Manet, a 1982 university graduate with a bachelor's degree in psychology, said she's never been abused on the job. What you get are people who are addicted to drugs getting beaten by their pimps or boyfriends, she said. That skews the results of any study about prostitution. I'm going to continue reading some of these stories, but as a kind of a interim gesture here, and also a chance to give me a chance to work on the machine, I'm going to play you a song by Mark Levy from, what's it called? Shiro's Heroes. This is about Joe Hill, activist from the beginning of the century who was unjustly murdered by the state.
Joseph Nostrom, better known as old Joe Hill, murdered by a firing squad, shot but never killed. His will said that his ashes be strewn across the land, so flowers that refuse to die will rise up strong and stand. We sing his songs to fan the flames and talk about him much. The ashes of this rebel voice are still too hot to touch. Joe's corpse lay in Chicago, where 30,000 marched. They flew the wobbly banner high above the throng it arched. The workers sang and cheered his name, they did not eulogize. They honored Joe Hill's last request, don't mourn, organize. Then the Union took Joe's body, which then they did cremate. His ashes stuffed in envelopes and mailed to every state. Except, of course, to Utah, for Joe had clearly said, don't leave me here in Utah, there I would be caught dead. We sing his songs to fan the flames and talk about him much. The ashes of this rebel voice are still too hot to touch. Then someone in the mailroom discovered what was up. Postmaster was summoned, the mailing to disrupt. An envelope tore open in the canceling machine. 'Twas just Joe's way of saying, automation is obscene. With patriotic fervor, this postmaster was seized. He treated that poor envelope as if it was disease. He said, I won't deliver such subversive mail. So for a while, Joe had to wait in some dead letter file. We sing his songs to fan the flames and talk about him much. The ashes of this rebel voice are still too hot to touch. At long last, the post office sent Joe's ashes to D.C. to the archives like an artifact of ancient history. The Wobblies in Chicago asked Betty B. sent home. They wouldn't see him cataloged down in that catacomb. So Joe's back with the Wobblies, and thus concludes my tale. But if there is a moral, I might say, don't trust the man.